Good morning to all brothers and sisters, friends, visitors. I bring the loving greetings from the Houston Ecclesia as we begin this week fraternal gathering on the high grounds. As we begin the study in this first chapter of the book of Deuteronomy this morning, we see that Israel is poised at the entrance to the land of Canaan. Moses took this opportunity to prepare the people for their new life, the land of inheritance. Moses, of course, would not be entering into that land, although Joshua and Caleb would. In all the Hebrew manuscripts, the Pentateuch forms one roll or volume divided into larger and smaller sections. Although it is not easy to say when it was divided into the five books, this was probably the first done by the Greek translators of the book, whom the Vulgate follows. It is derived from the Septuagint, but is somewhat of a misnomer, as it does not contain a second law, as that is mentioned in chapter 17, verse 18, a copy of this law, or more directly, repetition of the law. The fifth of these books was called by the Greeks Deuteronomion, that is, the name that we use, Deuteronomy, or a second statement of the laws already promulgated. The Jews designated the book by the first two Hebrew words that occur, Ella Hadabarim, which means these are the words. They divided into 11 parshiyoth, which we use in the English Bible as contained in 34 chapters. It consists chiefly of three discourses delivered by Moses a short time before his death. They were spoken to all in Israel in the plains of Moab in the 11th month of the last year of their wanderings. The first discourse, with which we are now concerned, takes up from chapters 1 through about chapter 4. It recapitulates the chief events of the last 40 years in the wilderness, with earnest exhortations to the obedience of the divine ordinances and warnings against the danger of forsaking the God of their fathers. The law was first brought to light to Moses on Mount Sinai and again specifically to the second generation of the Israelites out of Egypt as they entered the land of inheritance. With these instructions, Moses reminded Israel to remain faithful to the covenant and to remember their past history and future blessings or cursings as they entered the land of Canaan. As it is mentioned in the first verse, they were on this side Jordan, which is literally across the Jordan from the perspective of the land of Canaan. It says they were actually only 11 days' journey from Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, which had taken them nearly 40 years to complete their wanderings due to, you might say, a lack of discipline in following the instructions that were given. Brother Moore Stewart wrote a pamphlet entitled, as some of you know, Numbers and Colors as They Appear in Holy Scriptures. He mentions the significance of number 11 as a number that marks disorder, disorganization, or disintegration. And he gives three examples. The 11 dukes of Edom, which Edom is symbolic of the flesh. The 11 sons of Jacob, one is not, that was Joseph. And the 11th hour that speaks of turmoil just before Christ's return. Could it be that they were still incomplete in their understanding of following the instructions of Yahweh, as seen at the end of this chapter, when they were told not to go up and fight with the Amorites? Yahweh would not be with them. Yet they went anyway, and the Amorites chased them as bees do. In early Israel, dates were given with reference to the Exodus from Egypt. At this time in the chapter, it's about 40 years past that Exodus. It had taken Israel about a year to arrive at Kadesh Barnea from Mount Horeb, and another year to reach the place where Moses was addressing them in this passage. The 38 years between had been spent wandering in the desert, as they were in probation trying to acquire the mind of the Spirit. As we know that number 40 is associated with probation or trials. The victories that are mentioned in verse 4 of this chapter is a precursor of the victories that God would give the Israelites under Joshua's leadership. As it says on this side, Jordan, meaning east, the law was given. The door of the tabernacle was oriented east, and the temple, as seen in Ezekiel's prophecy, will be entered by Christ from the east. The instructions they received were to obtain the promised land, which extended from the Negev, or the south area, to the Euphrates River. This area was the land of the Amalekites during Abraham's day. It was also where Hagar was exiled. Eventually, David incorporated it into his kingdom, and Solomon established fortresses in the region. This was indeed the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their seed after them. Even today, we see some results of the Jewish people in the land producing an abundance of crops from what may appear to most as useless desert. In this part of chapter 1, we see Moses refer to the multitude of people as the stars of heaven in number, which were a burden unto him that he could not bear alone. For Yahweh hath made them 1,000 times so many as they were. We can only imagine the coordination and logistics involved with the crowd of this magnitude. The hand of God, as we know, was certainly directing the efforts of Moses. As we move into the next few verses, Moses attempts to lessen the burden by instructing the people to bring the wise men from their tribes, that he will make them heads over the people and captains over thousands, hundreds, fifties, tens, and officers of the tribes as well. The qualities of the leaders should reflect attributes of God. Wisdom refers to the ability to bring harmony even when great differences exist. Understanding refers to the ability to penetrate the realities of life from God's perspective and deal fairly with all parties in a dispute. The entire time spent in the wilderness should have shaped and molded the Israelites into vessels that were pleasing to Yahweh. But we know that man's way is not always God's way. In addition, as the judges were appointed, the congregation was to nominate, according to its tribes, wise, intelligent, and well-known men whom Moses would appoint as heads or judges over the nation. At their installation, he gave them the requisite instructions. Ye shall hear between your brethren, that is, hear both parties as mediators, and judge righteously without respect of person. To look at the face, equivalent to what situations we see in Leviticus chapter 19. The judgment is God's, or appointed by God, and to be administered in the name of God, or in accordance with His justice. Hence the expression, to bring before God, as seen in Exodus 21 and chapter 22. Moses had there explained to the Israelites that they had reached the mountainous country of the Amorites, which Jehovah was about to give them, and the land lay before them, that they might take possession of it without fear. As it says in verse 21, Behold, the Lord thy God has set the land before thee. Go up and possess it, as the Lord God of thy fathers has said unto thee, Fear not, neither be discouraged. Even though the future may have seemed uncertain to them, Moses exhorted them to have faith that Yahweh would watch over and guide them through all the unknowns. They had clearly witnessed the miracles of God during the wanderings throughout the wilderness. As they were instructed to go up and possess it, the reply of the people was, We will send men before us, and they shall search out the land and bring us word again by what way we may go up and into what cities we shall come. At this point, one would think that their faith would allow them to march straight into the cities and possess them as instructed by Yahweh through Moses. Why would they hesitate and return with the plan to send men and spy out the city, as mentioned in parallel chapter of Numbers 13? And Moses agreed with this plan. As the 12 men, one of a tribe, went into the mountain and then into the valley of Eshcol which means bunch or cluster. It was a region near Hebron. There they were made aware of the abundance of the land that the land offered, with grapes, pomegranates, and figs. And the land also flowed with milk and honey. As they were in this land for 40 days, they collected ample evidence that should have convinced them the area was well able to support their needs. But as in times past, they rebelled against Yahweh. As it mentions in Numbers 14, after the number of days in which ye searched out the land, even 40 days, each day for a year shall ye bear your iniquities. Even 40 years, and ye shall know my breach of promise. Moses was reminded of the whole congregation that rebelled at Kadesh and had fallen in the desert. But now a fresh generation was gathered around him. Moses points to the fact that the sinful corruption which broke out at that time and bore such bitter fruit had not died out with the older generation, but was germinating still in the existing Israel, and even though it might be deeply hidden in their hearts, would be sure to break forth again. The murmuring in the tents continued, and faith dwindled to the point that they were overcome with discouragement. Even with all the reasons to go in and possess the land, the report also came that the children of Anak, which means long-necked or strong-necked, were in the land and were known by the reputation of who can stand before the children of Anak. As we see in the parallel chapter 13 of Numbers, Caleb was willing to go in at once and possess it, believing that they were able to overcome. And chapter 13 is also mentioned of the servant Caleb, that he had another spirit within him. The mindset of Caleb was focused upon the commandments of Yahweh. But even the men that went up with him rebutted that the people were stronger than we, and they had failed to remain steadfast with Caleb. It is interesting that the name Caleb means dog. I don't know if there's any thoughts or comments that will be made on that. Be interesting to see where the discussion leads. Moses reminded them that Yahweh had watched over and protected them as a man doth bear his son. All they had to do was follow instructions. When they left the land of Egypt, they were following the pillar of smoke by day and the fire by night. Through all conditions of their wandering, Yahweh never failed to direct their path. As we know, those that were from 20 years old and upward, which have murmured against Yahweh, will not enter into the land, except, as mentioned before, Joshua and Caleb. Even Moses was restricted from entering the land, as noted in Numbers 20. And Moses lifted up his hand, and with his rod he smote the rock twice, and the water came out abundantly. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron, because ye believe me not, to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore ye shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. The one who was selected by Yahweh after 430 years to lead his people from slavery and the darkness of the Egyptian pharaohs, even he had failed to follow directions. At last, the people were ready to gird their weapons and go up upon the hill and fight. But the Lord said, go not up, I am not with you. In verse 43 of this chapter, it says they went presumptuously up to the hill. The word presumptuously is zed, a prime root, to seethe, or figuratively, to be insolent, which means boldly rude or disrespectful. Once again, we see the chosen people have decided to go about things their own way, and once again paid the price for disobeying the instructions from Yahweh. The Amorites came out against them and chased them as bees do, from Mount Seir, which means hairy or thicket, a mountain range that runs the length of the land of Edom. This was also home to Esau and his descendants. They chased them even unto Hormah, a place name meaning split rock or curse for destruction. It was a city marking the limit of the Canaanite route of the Israelites after their failed attempt to take over the land. Hopefully this has provided a few thoughts for discussion of this first chapter.
I always thought that if there was ever a list comprised of faithful servants to Yahweh, that Moses would definitely be way, way up the top of the list. How anybody could argue that he might not be number one, except for Christ, is he was so faithful right up to the end, and when he talks with God in the mount and pleads with him and pleads with him, you can hear the tears in his eyes as he speaks, with, "Let me go over into that goodly land." And God says, "Nope. You're not going over now." But much to our delight to keep us faithful and strong, Moses later in the Mount of Transfiguration is guaranteed a spot in that soon coming kingdom. So we'll now open up this remaining time for comments from the brethren about this chapter and the talk that was just given. Brother Philip?
I'd like to offer my thanks to Brother Mark for the details of these chapters out to us. And I think there was some very powerful lessons that that Brother Mark drew to our attention. I think it's really a good thing that we focus the power of God's word upon our own lives. And we've got such an incredible example of the children of Israel going through the wilderness. And the thing that struck me as Brother Mark developed his thoughts along this first chapter was this matter of spying out the land. And Brother Mark drew our attention to the parallel chapter in Numbers 13, where we learn that if we were just reading that particular chapter, we would think that it was God's intention to spy out the land. That was his plan, for the children of Israel to come out, send out men and spy the land. Yet we read in the chapter that Brother Mark has his study chapter this morning in Deuteronomy chapter 1, that the children of Israel said, "Well, can we go and spy out the land?" They came to Moses and asked, "Can we go and spy out the land? We'll send men out to spy the land." If we look at Ezekiel chapter 20 and verse 6, we find that Yahweh, in recounting the faithlessness of the children of Israel, refers to the fact that he had brought them out of the land of Egypt into a land that, and it says, that I had espied for them. So Yahweh had already espied the land. Well, of course, we know that Yahweh is cognizant of all lands everywhere throughout the globe. But he specifically says, "I had espied out the land for them." So putting these three different passages of Scripture together, we would suggest that the children of Israel, when they came forward to ask to spy out the land, Moses appears to have misinterpreted, perhaps, their intention. He said, "Oh, that was good in my eyes." He said that was a good thing to go and spy out the land. But Yahweh had really espied the land already and told them about it. It was a land flowing with milk and honey. And as Brother Mark said, what on earth was the problem with the children of Israel going forth as the cherubim of glory to go and take possession of the land? Now, it would seem, and these are only suggestions, that the children of Israel, even at this particular point, were lacking in that essential quality of faith. Yahweh had said, "Go and possess the land," but they wanted more evidence. But in a sense, Yahweh could work with that as well. He is aware of our own, being human beings, he's aware of our own limitations and our weaknesses, and he sanctions the request of the people. Yes, go on, but it was at his command. And so when we read it in Numbers chapter 13, it was, "I commanded them to go forth and spy the land." So we have these kind of different aspects and different angles to view these things. Yahweh had espied the land for them. They requested it, but from a different perspective, but Yahweh allows them to do so. And I think Brother Mark brought that out wonderfully this morning, because he basically referred to the fact that the land was flowing with milk and honey. It was a goodly land. So Yahweh was providing the opportunity for them to actually taste that a future inheritance. He was actually saying, well, okay, go and spy out that land yourselves. Look at the glorious fruit of the land. Look at its abundant crops, the fact that it's a beautiful land, it's flowing with milk and honey, and strengthen your faith with the vision of that glory and bring that report back to your brethren and sisters and encourage them to go forward. And I think that's a kind of an idea for us. Yahweh, in times such as these, when we're gathered together and we're feeding one another upon the glorious principles of the scriptures, we're sort of building up a picture, a future picture of glory, so that we are having, as it were, a taste of that glorious land to come. So that our faith in this day of darkness and trial might be strengthened and encouraged. And then we can go two ways on that. And so soon after those verses that Brother Mark drew our attention to, he said the children of Israel murmured in their tents. And Brother Mark exhorted us there, I think, in a powerful way that, I can't remember how Brother Mark put it, but basically when we look at the details in Numbers about just prior to them failing to go in, we see various aspects of them murmuring. And I think as Brother Mark really indicated to us, we've got a wonderful vision of glory before us. But if we decide to be murmurers and complainers in our tents, not here, we don't murmur here one with another, but when we go back from our ecclesias and within our homes, equivalent to tents, and we complain about Brother A or Sister B and we think about this, and we're really eroding our own faith. If we become murmurers and complainers, we're destroying not the people we're murmuring against, we're destroying ourselves. We're eroding our faith in the glory of the promised land. So I think Brother Mark has brought some really interesting information for us to consider this week.
Two at the same time. Go ahead, Justin.
I'd like to thank Brother Mark for his comments. I'd like to hear some comments maybe on the milk and honey that was mentioned. I get that honey probably wasn't very prevalent. It was difficult to get to and very valued, high valued. It's different for us. Obviously, we can just go to the store and pick it off the shelf. So we probably take that for granted. Milk, same way. I was just wondering, if what the thoughts on milk, was it not readily available back in these days and considered, something very valuable as well?
Brother David, you want to go next?
I don't have any comments to my immediately just on the milk and honey, but I'm sure some of the brethren have. Brother Mark did mention, and thanks, Brother Mark, for that introduction. He mentioned that Caleb means dog, and I actually really I think that's very interesting, because we know God is no respecter of persons, and there's a lot in Hebrew names. I can't help wondering exactly how some of these characters ended up with the names like Nabal. I mean, who would name the child Fool? I've got to wonder sometimes whether these names became the name that people knew them as. His mother may not have named him Fool, but because he was a fool, that's what people decided to name him. The fact that Caleb's name means dog is interesting, because we know that Christ said to the that faithful woman of Sarepta, it's not meet to take bread from the children and give it unto dogs. She was a Gentile. And in the scriptures, dogs was always a reference to Gentiles. They were, typically they were pagan, they were unclean, immoral, everything that God didn't want to see in the human race. And so God, by his own pen, denoted Gentiles as dogs. They were outside the covenants of promise, and they were completely outside the way of righteousness. So I think what we have with Caleb is it says that he was a son of Jephunneh. I don't know whether what Jephunneh was, who Jephunneh was exactly, but it would appear that he was half Jewish. He was of the tribe of Judah, so he was clearly Jewish to a point, but it seemed as if he had some Gentile in his background. And I think that's very interesting for us, in the sense that, as we said, God is no respecter of persons. So we have this man who's half Jewish, or certainly a good proportion Jewish, with some Gentile in his blood. And who are we? We are only Jews by adoption. We're naturally Gentiles. But did Caleb have any interest in the things of the Canaanites or in what the world had to offer? Not a bit of it. He was absolutely convinced that the promised land that God had promised them was not just theirs for the taking, but he would also participate in the extermination of all the evil in the land. People, idols, and everything associated with it. So I think there's I think it's quite interesting to think of Caleb there. You know, you've got Moses, you know, poor bread, Israelite, same as Joshua. But Caleb doesn't appear to be a poor bred Israelite. He's a Gentile, just like we are not naturally sons of Abraham, but we have adopted the faith of Abraham and are likewise heading for the land of promise if we're faithful.
Brother Owen?
Yeah, I think just to possibly try and answer that question about what a land flowing with milk and honey actually means, when I was in Israel, we discussed this quite a lot, and the Israelis thought that it meant a land that's sort of unspoilt by man and not yet fully cultivated, so just a natural land that hadn't really been fully occupied by man and started to cultivate it. So, for example, when natural flowers grow and there's lots of flowers and it hasn't been spoilt by man, you'll have lots of natural flowers and then lots of bees will come, and so naturally you'll have lots of naturally occurring beehives, such as when, you know, Jonathan went into the forest and found honey dripping from the woods. But once you start, and also once you've got natural grassland and natural flowers, you'll have lots of goats and sheep, which again will provide the milk. But the minute man comes along and starts to cultivate it, cut down trees, all the, you know, hives in the forest disappear at that point. When you start to cultivate crops, all the naturally occurring flowers and everything else disappears. So bees disappear, crops grow instead of flowers, and therefore bees can't pollinate it as such, which means that really that suggests a land that's not yet cultivated, that's all natural, and that the Israelites can then go in to inherit and take control of all that land. So that seems to be what I think it means.
Brother Jim Somerville.
Land flowing with milk and honey. Indeed, what he says is what the land means, and it was a good land. That means that flowers were growing and cattle could feed, and it was something worth taking. But it's also interesting to note in, I believe it's Isaiah chapter 7, that Isaiah is talking about the Assyrian government destroying their crops. And he says it's going to be a land of milk and honey, not as a blessing, but as a curse. And it's just the reverse of what Brother Ewing was saying. Instead of having crops growing and cultivating the land and having their wheat and rye and barley and things that they would cultivate, it was going to go back to a natural land flowing with milk and honey, where cattle would be grazing on the field and the wild flowers would be growing. And so it's used both ways, both as a blessing and as a cursing, or as a good land and a good thing and a bad thing, depending on the perspective. It's also interesting to note here in both Brother Mark and Brother Philip's comment about the murmurings of the children of Israel. You know, as young people or young in the truth even, you say, why did they murmur? They had so much. You know, they had so obviously been given the hand of God with them. Why were they murmuring? And you go to Kadesh Barnea, and you understand why they were murmuring. As they said, this is not a land it wasn't a land of milk and honey. He said, this is no place for crops. It was like crushed stone that's underfoot for miles and miles and miles and just hills. Nothing, no place to dwell, no place that you'd want to live. And they dwelt a long time in that area. So by natural means, they had reason to complain. And I think the exhortation that Paul gives to the Philippians, do all things without murmurings and disputings. Now, that's a command. And we've got, I don't know how many people this week, they said there was going to be over a couple hundred people. and there's been some changes in the schedule, and there's going to be some changes in the meals. And how many complaints, or how many of us will be here this week and can go to week and do all things without murmurings and disputings? You mentioned that, well, we won't do it here, we'll do it in our homes. No, we'll do it here. A lot of us will, because that's who we are, and that's what we're made of, and that's the flesh. And we've got to fight against that, every one of us, whether you're last in line and there's no food, or whether it's hot in here and it's, you know, there'll be something to complain about. The flesh will find something to complain about. And yet it is the flesh. And Israel, of course, they didn't come right out. Like Brother Phil said, the God had espied out the land. It is a good land, flowing with milk and honey. There was no need for them to check it out. And yet God will work with us if we have, you know, a legitimate reason. He worked, we think of Lot, you know, flee to this city. Flee to the mountains. Well, how about this city? You know, how about Zor? It's only a little city. Can I go there? God says, okay, I'll hear you on this thing too. Go there. If it's not out of harmony with God's purpose, he sometimes acquiesces to our wishes. Israel wanted to go out and spy the land. And they wanted to see which way they should go up to search out the place, to pitch our tents, to show you the way that you should go. You know, but when they got there, instead of seeing that the way they should go and how they should pitch, and they looked and they said, oh, this is going to be tough. And so they started murmuring, and they brought back the evil report. And it starts off with maybe not the faith they should have had, but maybe not a bad thing either. But we start down that road, and it's so easy to get discouraged and complain if it's not exactly the way we had hoped it would be. And the exhortation is to us, our life isn't going to be the way we want it to be. We will meet trials, we will meet tribulations, and that's our lot. Every one of us will face temptation and trial, and yet to murmur is to sin. And so we've got to guard our mouth and faithfully move on.
Should I let you guys fight over who goes first? Both hands went up at the same time. Brother Johnny?
Brothers and sisters, I was thinking about what Brother Jim was saying about it being both ways as far as the milk and honey. But with it comes the bees. And if you've ever gotten into a beehive you didn't expect, you can't get away fast enough. And that's what they found themselves going in, boldly going in and quickly turn around as fast as they could. It's interesting that God tells them, they shall chase you as bees do. And so that's what's interesting about it, that what should have been to their benefit and to their blessing was turned against them. God can teach us in different ways and use the very thing that we should have used for our advantage to make us realize we got to turn around and think a different way. The other thing I was thinking about was the verse 17 there, when he's setting up the officers underneath the people, even though they're leaders of them and we are all equal brothers and sisters. It's very similar to our situation in that we have each other for advice and support and to evaluate matters in our lives and to go to for support and help. We look at that verse 17 says, and the cause that is too hard for you, bring it unto me and I will hear it. Now, this was Moses speaking, and Moses was the mediator for the children of Israel. Jesus is our mediator. And there's times in our lives with physical problems, medical problems, ecclesial problems, there is no brother or sister that can help us. Nobody. We can go to them for advice. We can try to evaluate what to do about problems, no matter what they are. But we must go through our mediator to God. And it's the same situation they were in, that when we are at, or as we would say, our wit's end, it's come to me and I will hear it.
Brother Burrow.
If we look at the 31st verse, it says that God bore them and the man does his son. Well, I one time heard a highly intelligent brother in the world, in the truth, say that I can pretty much take anything, but if you mess with my kids, we're going to have a problem. And here God is saying that he treated them as a man has borne his sons while they were in the wilderness. Now, if I understood the question right, and I might not have, one of the questions was the milk and honey, was it readily available? But while they were in the wilderness, it was not readily available. They didn't have a lot, and as Brother Jim pointed out, they were in a pretty sparse land. So here we have God saying that I'm going to treat you as you are my sons, and we have the children of Israel in a sparse land with nothing. They were hungry. They were thirsty. They didn't have a lot of the comforts that they had when they were in Egypt, even though they were slaves. I mean, they were on stony, rocky ground walking. They didn't have a lot. And yet God still says, I have borne them as a man born his sons. And in the next chapter, he says they lacked for nothing. They lacked nothing. They were hungry. They were thirsty. They were suffering. And they lacked nothing. Just because we come across a time of trial or a time of evil, that's for our benefit. That's to help us grow in knowledge and grow in dependence upon God. That's it. It's not bad. I mean, everybody here with kids has punished their kids one way or another at some point in time, trying to get them to act the way we think they should. Trying to get them the way society says they should act. And it's no different with us. We're children in the eyes of God. He flat out says it. He bears the children of Israel as he bears a man bears his son. And therefore, as was pointed out about the murmuring and the suffering, it's part of life. It's part of the lot. It's part of the things that we need to learn in order to serve God more acceptably, to help build our dependence upon him. It's not unknown to God what we're going through. It's not something that is a stranger. It's there. And if things change, most people, in my experience, don't like change. But it's there. It happens. It's part of life. And as Brother Jim was saying, and Brother John was saying, we don't really shouldn't talk a whole lot against it. But it's part of life. And it's part of the things that we go through in order that we can draw near to God and understand just how dependent we are on him. You know, Israel's hungry, they're suffering, they're thirsty. And they lacked nothing because they had God with them the entire time. He was in the pillar and the cloud. He was with Israel. Therefore, they lacked nothing.
So as long as we're looking at names, Caleb does indeed mean dog, even gives the idea of rabid, so maybe uncivilized. But looking at his father's name, Jephunneh, and he was a Kenizzite, so he was a Gentile, it says in Jesenius that his name means for whom a way is prepared. So in this way, you got the idea that there's a way prepared for the Gentiles to be coming into a covenant relationship with God. So.
Brother Dan.
In our reading that we read, it kind of struck me as we were reading through verse 3, that, and I believe Brother Mark brought this out, that Moses spake unto the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him in commandment unto him. It seems to be the common denominator of the book of Deuteronomy and this whole week which is in front of us. He spoke according to all that the Lord had given in commandment unto them. And that really is what our whole goal here is to refocus ourselves in all the commandments, all that we've been asked to do. And like Israel, as Brother Jim brought out, like Israel, we tend to want to complain, we want to murmur, but also we want to point the finger. And they were no different, because in verse 27 it says, because the Lord hated us, he hath brought us forth out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. It's real easy to point the finger at other people for our mistakes. He spoke unto them all, according to all the commandments of the Lord. And this week, while we go through the various chapters in Deuteronomy and the exhortations, it really would do us good to focus on ourselves, to examine ourselves without pointing the finger. And I remember Brother Epaphras once said in an exhortation that if you're pointing the finger, you'll generally find four pointing back at you. And so as Israel pointed to the ultimate, to God as the fault for their failure and for their destruction, we have to be very careful, because a little bit farther down when they required the help of God, he says, I'm not here to help you. I'm not listening anymore, but I'm just telling you, don't go up and fight against the Amorites. Say to them, go up, neither fight, for I am not among you, lest ye be smitten before your enemies. So the warning is very clear to us. As we have been given all the commandments, let us not point the finger, especially back at God, for our faults. Otherwise, he will not hear our prayers. I'd
like to thank all the brethren for the many comments that they offered.